Welcome to the Functional Medicine Podcast with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay. We're coming to you from McMinn Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, where Dr. McMinn is an integrative and functional MD, and Lindsay Matthews is a registered nurse and IIN certified health coach. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the latest information on a wide range of topics in the field of functional medicine, which looks for the root cause of disease, and integrative medicine, which incorporates both conventional and alternative therapies. Our overall goal is to help you be the best that you can be in mind, body, and spirit. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without approval from your personal doctor. And now, on to the show with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay.
Welcome back to the Functional Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jim McMinn. We're excited to have you with us today. And I'm here with my co-host, health coach, BFF, Nurse Lindsay Matthews.
Thank you, Dr. McMinn. Hello, everybody. We're excited to be back with you today. And we have a really interesting and important topic for you today, and that is PCOS, which stands for polycystic ovary syndrome.
Yeah, Coach, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. It's really an interesting subject. A lot of people have never heard of PCOS, but it's much more common than you would expect, and it can have a huge impact on a woman's life. We see quite a few women with this at our clinic, and usually our treatments really seem to help these women. It makes a real difference in their quality of life. I do want to apologize. This podcast is a little bit long, but it's just so much to talk about. It's such an interesting subject. And I also want to mention, if you're like me, you're probably driving along or walking or doing something else. You can't really take notes while you listen to this. So we are going to transcribe this and put that transcription on the website. You can find that at functionalmedicinepodcast.com in the documents section.
You know, apologies, but also no apologies. We get to be thorough and fact-based and research-focused, evidence-based focused, and that's a joy, and that's exciting to just unpack for you guys. So PCOS is the most common endocrine disorder of reproductive aged women. Around 12% of women are diagnosed with PCOS, and that comes to about 5 million women in the U.S. alone. So this is significant numbers here. And we also realize though that not everyone listening to the podcast lives in the US, and we don't want to be US centric. So worldwide, the prevalence is somewhere between 2-26%. So as you can see, that's variable, but it's interesting that PCOS is more common in developed countries, which is why we might see that variability in that statistic. Where in more developed countries, we happen to have just more processed foods, more industrial toxins, more antibiotics. Dr. Mack, I'm just saying.
Probably just a coincidence, Lindsay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but as functional medicine folks, we're always interested in the why of disease. So in this case, why do women get PCOS? This is becoming a very interesting question, and the science continues to evolve, and we're learning more about it. But evidence is emerging that there are many different factors that contribute to the development of PCOS. I have a theory that just about all diseases come from really four different factors. A couple of years ago, I made a graphical representation of this, and if you can go to the website, to functionalmedicinepodcast.com, you can see this under the heading of diagrams. The four factors are the genome, the microbiome, the exposome, and the mind. And when I say exposome, I mean exposure to things like toxins, infectious diseases, trauma, drugs, connection with nature, and certain nutrients or lack thereof. The confluence of these four factors is where diseases emerge.
I love that diagram, Dr. McMinn. And I think that's also such a great thing to bring up at the beginning of this podcast, because some people might write off the podcast and be like, well, this doesn't apply to me. Mm-hmm. But when we understand the principles of functional medicine, of root cause, and we understand this diagram that you're talking about, you know, it helps us just have a broader picture of what we are looking at, that this could be not just PCOS, but, you know, those factors contribute to other diseases. Right. So a lot of these principles we're talking about here are applicable even in other situations and not just PCOS. Mm-hmm. But PCOS is no exception to the diagram that you have, in that all four of those factors really swirl together and affect people that have PCOS. So as far as the genome is concerned, there's definitely an inherited risk for PCOS. So a study right down the street from us here in Birmingham at UAB, University of Alabama, found that 24% of women in the U.S. with PCOS had a mom with PCOS, and 32% of these women had a sister with PCOS, which is significantly greater than just the general population. So we see that the risk is also higher if a woman's twin sister has PCOS. So to be clear on this point, just because a patient has PCOS doesn't mean that her mom or her sister or her daughter will necessarily get it, though. But mm-hmm. certainly we see this genetic link.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Lindsay, there's certainly a genetic component. And a study published in the Journal of Cell Metabolism stated that epigenetics also plays a role. In other words, these genes can be turned on or turned off.
Yay.
Isn't it interesting? And the authors discovered that, for instance, DNA hypomethylation regulates key genes associated with PCOS. Another factor that regulates these genes or genetic expression is the exposure to environmental toxins, especially in this case, the endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Studies show that exposure to those endocrine disrupting chemicals like plastics and pesticides that mimic a woman's hormones may contribute to altered fetal programming and in consequence can lead to PCOS as that fetus matures into adulthood. So, for instance, a study published by the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism showed significantly higher levels of BPA from plastics in women with PCOS than in the control group. In this case, timing is everything. The most susceptible time is in the early developmental period. So that would include like a fetus in utero and then infants and then young children. That's when they're most susceptible to that exposure of BPA. Mm-hmm. So if a female is exposed to those chemicals during those stages in life, then she's particularly vulnerable to getting PCOS from that BPA exposure, and the symptoms then develop later on in life.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Yes. And, you know, Lindsay, I remember years ago, you know, I've been listening to podcasts forever. I just love podcasts and love learning, you know. So I was driving along, and I was listening to a podcast on PCOS, and I really wish I could remember who the speaker was. I'd love to give her credit, but I distinctly remember her saying, quote, "Girls who drink out of plastic bottles have more PCOS," end quote. Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Yeah, wow. But if you look around, you know, unfortunately, you see girls drinking out of plastic bottles all the time, even microwaving food in plastic containers. And as patients and doctors, we tend to really be pretty oblivious to the issue of toxins and their effect. And it's really a big deal, especially when it comes to these endocrine issues. So if you want to learn more about this, then go back and please take a look at our podcast that we did last time on toxins.
Yes, that was a fun podcast. Mm-hmm. That was a good one. Mm-hmm. And speaking of toxins, a nationwide study in Sweden showed that women who smoke during pregnancy are more likely to have a daughter with PCOS. We know that there are many different kinds of toxins in cigarette smoke, and so then here's the other kicker with that. These toxins can have a negative effect over multiple generations. So that means if grandma or even great-grandma was exposed to those endocrine-disrupting chemicals, then the granddaughter would have an increased risk of PCOS.
Wow, that's crazy, Lindsay.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? Well,
yes.
That's called transgenerational. That's unbelievable. So anyway, the story of PCOS often starts with the fetus in the womb. That's when mom secretes excess amounts of something called anti-Müllerian hormone during pregnancy. This leads to a cascade of alterations impacting the maternal brain, the ovaries, and the placenta. This results in a strong elevation in maternal luteinizing hormone and testosterone and a drop in progesterone and estradiol. Ultimately, this reprograms the fetus and induces PCOS in the offspring.
Wow.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then we can kind of move beyond genetics, and we also see that there may even be an autoimmune component to PCOS. Another study in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology showed a statistically significant higher level of anti-ovarian antibodies in women with PCOS as compared to the controls. And then even more interesting, we also see that if a woman has PCOS, then she has a significant increase in her risk of getting other autoimmune diseases, especially Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is just to your point, mm-hmm. Dr. Rittman, you mm-hmm. always talk about yep. once you start that one mm-hmm. disease of autoimmune, you are mm-hmm. so much more likely to have a cascade
That's
of
right.
other autoimmune mm-hmm. diseases.
That's because they all have the same common denominator, which is gut issues, right?
Right.
And so if you listen to our previous podcast, you know the holy grail of autoimmune disease is the gut. Interestingly, studies show that women with PCOS have an altered gut microbiome. These women with PCOS have less microbial diversity in their microbiome than women without PCOS. PCOS women also exhibit alterations in some of the markers for gut barrier function and the endotoxemia that results from this. Endotoxemia, by the way, just means that the bacterial fragments are leaking through the leaky gut into the bloodstream and causing a toxic, inflammatory, and immune response. In fact, a prospective case-controlled study from the journal Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism concluded that, quote, an unhealthy gut microbiome may be the hallmark of PCOS among teens, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting. They found a lower percentage of relative abundance of the beneficial bacteria called Bacteroidaceae, and this conferred a 4.4 times increased likelihood ratio of PCOS diagnosis, and that's huge. We also see that these women with PCOS have more IBS than other women. Interestingly, these women with PCOS not only have alterations in their gut microbiome, they also have an altered vaginal microbiome as compared to women without PCOS. I also ran across a really interesting study published in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences, where they did a fecal transplant from PCOS women into mice, and the mice then developed ovarian dysfunction, insulin resistance, immune changes, all of which are similar to the syndrome of PCOS, and it all comes from a fecal transplant.
That's some pretty bad poop right there.
That is.
Oh, my goodness, that's unbelievable that just from that bacterial transplant, you could reproduce the disease. That's unbelievable. Then we got to bring up one of my favorite topics, Dr. McMahon, stress. And stress can affect just about every disease known to man and women, but many experts agree that stress can contribute to the development of PCOS, and certainly it can exacerbate existing PCOS. And then beyond that, we also see that women that have PCOS, it can cause more stress in them due to the symptoms and things associated with it. Mm-hmm. But then also, those women that have PCOS have an exaggerated stress response. They have this hyper stress response. So in a study published in the Journal of Psychoneuroendocrinology, the authors found that PCOS patients showed enhanced HPA axis and heart rate reactivity in response to stress. So we also know that women with PCOS have way more depression and anxiety than the controls. So certainly stress is a big factor here.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And I think we understand stress is a big factor in many of the diseases that patients present with, isn't it, Lindsay?
Yes.
Last potential cause of PCOS that we'll mention, although I'm sure there are others, is the issue of nutrition. A study from the European Journal of Endocrinology stated that a low vitamin D is associated with the development of PCOS. 44% of women with PCOS are vitamin D deficient compared to only 11% of controls. So the lower your vitamin D, the greater your risk of chances of being diagnosed with PCOS. Very interesting. As you know by now, if you've been listening to our podcast at McMahon Clinic, we're very bullish on vitamin D optimization. Low vitamin D has been associated with many kinds of bandages, from heart disease to immune dysfunction and even increased mortality. So now we see that low vitamin D is also linked with PCOS.
And the official jury is still out there as to whether diet can actually cause PCOS. However, a high-sugar modern American diet, that's SAD, standard American diet, can cause an increased insulin level, and high insulin levels can cause elevated androgens, which then drive PCOS symptoms. So a case could definitely be made that poor diet can also be a trigger for PCOS.
So the bottom line is that PCOS is caused by a multitude of factors: genetics, microbiome, toxins, nutrition, stress, etc. The same factors that cause many other diseases. These factors converge, and then they express in this complex endocrine and metabolic disorder known as PCOS.
And now that we've discussed the whys of PCOS, let's talk exactly about what PCOS is. So PCOS is a complex hormonal and metabolic disorder which results in a combination of signs and symptoms, which may include ovarian dysfunction, like ovarian cysts, widespread hormone dysfunction, insulin resistance, chronic systemic inflammation, androgen excess, and specifically when we're talking about androgens, we're talking about testosterone and DHEA.
Well, that's a lot, isn't it, Lindsay?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a significant disease. And some of the signs and symptoms of PCOS may include acne, facial hair, excess body hair. These women also have, I'll use a very medical term here, let's see, funky periods,
yes.
Which means it could be irregular periods or no periods at all, or cycles lasting over 35 days. Other issues include weight gain, especially around the middle, dark spots on the skin, especially the neck, groin, and armpits, skin tags, pelvic pain, difficulty getting pregnant, frequent miscarriages, and all that kind of stuff.
So women with PCOS also tend to produce too much cortisol. So that's the other hormone that mm-hmm. we can talk about here. And on top of that, they also don't metabolize that cortisol efficiently. So too much, and it's not being regulated properly. They also have abnormal 24-hour cortisol cycles. So this results in increased appetite, overeating, weight gain, mood problems, and sleep disorders.
Women with PCOS also have an increased association with other health problems, such as cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, obstructive sleep apnea, mood disorders like anxiety and depression, metabolic syndrome, libido issues, scalp hair loss, elevated cholesterol, high homocysteine levels, endometrial cancer, autoimmune thyroiditis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and an increased risk of strokes.
One of the hallmarks of PCOS is poor aromatization, or the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. And this creates a hormonal imbalance with high testosterone and relatively low estrogen. And since there are hormone receptors in every cell in the body, then PCOS becomes a whole body disease, not just an ovary disease. That's why all these things we're talking about are just hitting all these different body systems. Often what brings the women to the doctor, of course, is just the cosmetic concerns like acne or facial hair, which are a big deal for us as mm-hmm, women. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to minimize that.
Right.
PCOS is way more complicated, though, than just acne and facial hair. At the upper end of the spectrum, it can have profound implications on morbidity, mortality, and quality of life. It's almost kind of like those are the tip mm-hmm. of the iceberg, mm-hmm. and right. underneath the surface, there's right. all these other things brewing.
Yeah.
So early diagnosis and treatment is really important for us as women mm-hmm. with PCOS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lindsay, it's so interesting. I think a lot of women go through life and have these symptoms, and they go undiagnosed with these symptoms for years before somebody
right.
kind of connects the dots and puts it all together and puts a label on it, which is unfortunate because I think the earlier you start treatment, then the better off they'll be. So let's talk about how to actually diagnose the PCOS. There's no single definitive test for PCOS, and different experts disagree on what constitutes a diagnosis of PCOS. However, most agree that it's mainly a clinical diagnosis, which means that if you have some of the clinical symptoms that Lindsay outlined above and other conditions have been ruled out that might cause these symptoms, then you may have PCOS. The three major things we look for are signs and symptoms, the transvaginal ultrasound looking for polycystic ovaries, and the lab work. The major authoritative governing bodies have associated a somewhat different criteria for the diagnosis of PCOS. In 1990, a consensus workshop sponsored by the NIH and the Androgen Excess and PCOS Society suggested that a woman has PCOS if she has all of the following: oligo-ovulation, which means irregular or infrequent periods, signs of androgen excess, clinical or biochemical, exclusion of other disorders that can result in menstrual irregularity or hyperandrogenism. By the way, the biochemical hyperandrogenism just means that you have an elevated level of testosterone and or DHA on your labs. However, it's hard to find any hard and fast rules as to what exactly the cutoff is for these elevated testosterone or DHA levels. And the clinical hyperandrogenism just means that you have labs that they may be normal, but you have symptoms of androgen excess, like the jawline, acne, and the facial hair. Note that in this definition of PCOS, they make no mention of ovarian cysts at all. So to be clear, you could have polycystic ovary syndrome with no ovarian cyst at all. So the actual name PCOS is really a misnomer to start with. Some experts are actually lobbying to change the name to something more relevant that will more accurately reflect what's going on with these women.
Hmm. And there's a whole other criteria set called the Rotterdam criteria, which states that you can have PCOS if you have any of the following two things going on: changes in ovulation, or clinical or biochemical hyperandrogenism, or polycystic ovaries on an ultrasound. So by this standard, you can have PCOS without any androgen symptoms or elevated androgen labs. So this becomes controversial, since some experts feel that if you don't have androgen excess labs or symptoms, then you don't have PCOS. So we can see why women don't get diagnosed with it or aren't aware of it or don't seek treatment for it.
That's right, Lindsay. And the bottom line, the diagnosis can be very confusing, and reasonable people and even experts can disagree on what constitutes PCOS or whether or not a particular woman has PCOS. The way I see it, if you have labs consistent with androgen excess and or symptoms of androgen excess, like jawline, acne, facial hair, and other things have been ruled out, like congenital adrenal hyperplasia or elevated prolactin, then you probably have PCOS. At least you're somewhere on the spectrum. And that's especially true if you have the irregular periods. Let me make one other comment on the periods, Lindsay. This is kind of interesting. People can have regular periods and still have ovulatory dysfunction. And the reason is because they have anovulatory periods, right? Mm-hmm. So just because you're having normal periods doesn't necessarily mean that your ovaries are hunky-dory, okay?
You can still have ovarian dysfunction. No egg is released during that cycle.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if you don't have androgen labs or androgen symptoms at all, then you probably don't have PCOS. And these androgen symptoms may include things like acne on the face, neck, chest, back, especially jawline, loss of scalp hair, excess facial or body hair, excess hair in the upper inner thighs, or pubic hair that grows up in a line towards the stomach, and towards the umbilicus or the belly button, and hair around the nipples.
PCOS also tends to produce different patterns of symptoms at different stages in life. So before puberty, a young girl can have weight gain, acne, and high blood sugar. And then it's these girls that tend to also start their periods early. And as an adolescent, she may have all of the above issues and also experience irregularity in her periods, mood disorders, which can be really severe.
And even approaching things like rage. And it's really unfair to these young girls because, in their heart of hearts, they're nice girls, but they are just angry at the world. And it's just kind of their hormones manipulating them like a puppet on a string, really. But in the reproductive years, she might struggle with infertility, gestational diabetes, and preeclampsia. And finally, in the perimenopausal years, then she can have increased risk of obesity, diabetes, stroke, heart disease, and uterine cancer.
At the McMinn Clinic, we consider PCOS to be a spectrum disorder, and I find that description to be one of the most helpful things when talking about this. Mm-hmm. You can be low on the spectrum and just have some mild symptoms, and people may never know that you even have PCOS, or you might not know that you have PCOS.
Or your doctor might not know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Uh-huh. And then that PCOS goes undiagnosed, and for many women, it never causes a problem at all, but then in about 70% of women with PCOS, they just don't even know it. So it's interesting.
And on the other end of the spectrum, and I've seen this before, it's really interesting, Lindsay, a woman can walk into the room, and if you're a trained observer, you can look at her and say, whoa, she's got PCOS. It's just kind of that obvious. She's got all the features. She's got the body habitus and the facial hair and the acne, and you just know she's got PCOS, right? And sometimes in my mind, I'm thinking, I wonder if she sees a doctor who has diagnosed it.
Does she know?
Yeah, does she know? Does she even know, right?
So likewise with the associated conditions to PCOS, like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, women with PCOS may be affected with these conditions to a different degree or maybe not even at all. So they may fall in the spectrum where diabetes and cardiovascular disease are affecting them or not at all. So just because you have PCOS does not mean that you are necessarily going to get diabetes or that you're going to be infertile or have any other of the associated complications. It's a spectrum.
Let me also make one more comment on this diagnosis issue. I think it's incumbent upon providers, everybody, whether it be functional medicine provider, OBGYNs, nurse practitioners, whoever, to really have a high index of suspicion for these women, to really have it on your radar screen, because so many times people come in with something simple like acne, and doctors just don't connect the dots, right? And so I think that it needs to be in the forefront of our mind. Certainly, we don't want to go and look at the world through PCOS glasses, right? There are mold glasses and there are toxin glasses and all kind of glasses, right? But having said that, I think we have to have a high index of suspicion for it. Some experts actually describe four types of PCOS. The first type is insulin-resistant PCOS. This is the most common type of PCOS and accounts for about 70% of cases. With this type, you'll often see a high blood sugar, high hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of blood sugar average, and a high fasting insulin on the labs. Sometimes you'll also see high triglycerides and a metabolic syndrome pattern in the cholesterol panel. These women often suffer from mid-abdominal weight gain due to the influence of the insulin, and there's also a risk of developing type 2 diabetes in these women. All of these are associated with comorbidities and that go along then with the diabetes. When your cells are resistant to insulin, then the insulin builds up in the blood, and this excess insulin impairs ovulation, causes an increase in testosterone production, causes inflammation, and it also lowers your SHBG, which is your sex hormone binding globulin, which frees up even more of your testosterone to become active. So in addition to these diabetic concerns, these women also suffer from androgenic effects such as PCOS, like the acne and facial hair.
And the second most common type of PCOS is called post-pill PCOS, or it may also be called pill-induced PCOS, which occurs in women after stopping the birth control pill. After women come off the pill, they often get an androgen surge, which then develops into PCOS. And the good news is that the androgens may come down on their own, but it may take a year or two for this to happen. So on the labs with this type of PCOS, you'll see high androgen levels, and or these women will have androgenic symptoms like acne or hirsutism. And the tip-off is that they'll tell you that this all started after stopping the pill.
Especially if you ask them.
Yes.
They might not think
they
it's
might
you.
Not so, recognize so, that so pattern.
Sometimes you got to
exactly.
ask them the question.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the third type of PCOS is called inflammatory PCOS, and these women often have gut issues such as IBS, food sensitivities, histamine intolerance, autoimmune disease, thyroid disease, chronic fatigue, joint pain, headaches, and skin problems like eczema or hives. On the labs, you'll often find high C-reactive protein or other markers of inflammation.
And then the final type of PCOS is sometimes called adrenal PCOS. And on the labs for these women, you'll see that testosterone, which comes from the ovaries, is normal, but the androgen DHEA, which comes from the adrenal glands, is elevated. So this form of PCOS is due to the epigenetic upregulation of DHEA from your adrenal glands. Clinically, these women also present with androgenic symptoms.
But no matter what kind of PCOS you have or a woman might have, an early diagnosis and a robust customized treatment protocol gives the patient her best chance of minimizing adverse symptoms and also of avoiding potential complications of PCOS like the diabetes, heart disease, and other things that we've already mentioned.
The goals of treatment are to decrease excess androgens and androgenic symptoms like acne, facial hair, scalp hair loss, and attain and maintain that ideal body weight, reduce inflammation, reduce the insulin resistance, provide that hormonal balance, improve metabolic markers like cholesterol and triglycerides, improve ovulatory function, improve fertility when desired, and then also improve mood and anxiety disorders and minimize, like you said, Dr. McMinn, those secondary outcomes like diabetes and heart disease.
It's a lot to work on in it, Lindsay.
It sure is.
lots of goals there, for sure.
Yes.
But the good news is I think it can often be done.
Yes.
So now let's talk about how to treat PCOS. And let me preface this by stating that you must be patient with these treatments. It can take 6 to 12 months to really see improvement. It's also not a one-size-fits-all approach. It must be customized for each patient. And usually the program will have to be tweaked over time. If Plan A doesn't do the job, then you have to go on to Plan B.
And in the interest of being thorough, we're discussing many therapeutic options, just like we've kind of tried to give you a really broad perspective of what causes PCOS. So don't be overwhelmed, listeners. Our intent is not that you're going to do all the things that we will discuss, but instead it's got to be tailored so that the different modalities and therapies are appropriate to you as the patient. And what's really going to help you here is if you work with an integrative or functional medical provider to create that based on your situation.
Mm. Yeah. This is really just kind of a therapeutic toolbox
and
to choose from, right? And also, it's important to state that some of the drugs and supplements used for the treatment have warnings and contraindications, so please work with a provider who is knowledgeable with these medications and supplements. From the conventional point of view, the mainstays of treatment of PCOS are birth control pills and metformin. The birth control pills tend to increase sex hormone binding globulin and therefore decrease the level of active testosterone, and then that reduces the androgen symptoms. However, the birth control pills have their own set of concerns. We could and perhaps should do a whole podcast on this with potential adverse side effects of the birth control pill, but we won't go into this at this time. However, we do feel that women need to be better educated as to the potential downside effects of the birth control pills so that they can make an informed decision.
Absolutely. Education is power.
And as you know, Lindsay, we've always been into women empowerment.
Yes.
Right. Patient empowerment, too, right?
Yes. We all,
patients need to be empowered, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. If you have all that information, then you can make the decision.
Right.
One of the first therapeutic modalities we're going to talk about here is metformin, and that's a common name. Most mm-hmm. all of you guys have probably heard of metformin before or have a family member who's been on it. So metformin works by improving insulin sensitivity. So increasing metformin, metformin restores menstrual cycles in about 50% of women with PCOS, which a lot of people find mm-hmm. to be pretty shocking because mm-hmm. they think it's just a sugar pill. But it also can significantly improve fertility rates, reduce gestational diabetes, and can help with weight loss and reduce the patient's risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
Metformin is a Category B drug, and this means that it's generally regarded as safe during pregnancy. However, it is not without controversy. Metformin does cross the placenta and circulates in the developing fetus. Some studies suggest that it increases the risk of obesity in the offspring. So there are differing opinions on the use of metformin in women who are pregnant or trying to get pregnant. However, overall, this is a good drug for many women with insulin-resistant PCOS.
With a traditional doctor, if you have infertility issues with PCOS, then you'll usually start seeing a fertility specialist as well, and they will usually start with fertility drugs like Clomid for this. But if you have acne, facial hair, or hair loss, then spironolactone might be the first line drug of choice in that situation. And the spironolactone as a drug can be very helpful for controlling those symptoms. However, it can also prevent healthy ovulation. So it's contraindicated in pregnancy or if you're trying to get pregnant. So it's not the right drug when we're talking about fertility. Traditional doctors also have their usual lineup of drugs that can be used for other symptoms of PCOS, like depression, anxiety, that PCOS women face.
Mm-hmm. Now, and all those things could be helpful, and I'm very grateful for all of all the wonderful OBGYNs and primary care doctors out there who treat PCOS with those tools. But from the integrative and functional medicine point of view, there are many additional tools in our toolbox to treat PCOS. And like with many conditions, we start by looking at the underlying root causes of the disease, which in this case include the things like the genetics and epigenetics, microbiome, toxins, nutrition, stress, all the other stuff we've already talked about.
Right.
So we mentioned that one of the major factors that influence genetic expression is the exposure to toxins, in this case, especially the EDCs or endocrine disrupting chemicals. Therefore, toxin avoidance and some basic detox measures may be helpful. And for details on this subject, please go back and check out our previous podcast on the subject of toxins. And we go into that in great detail there. Also, we already mentioned that the hypomethylation issue could be a factor. So how to manage this issue is quite controversial, and it's really beyond the scope of this podcast. But certainly taking a good methylated B-complex vitamin would be a good place to start. Our choice is something called methyl-CpG by Orthomolecular, one pill once a day, or you might find this in your multivitamin, if it's a good multivitamin, or in a good prenatal vitamin. And by the way, throughout this section, we'll be mentioning other supplements that might be helpful, and I will make a list of these for you and the dosages that might be helpful and some of the brand names, and you can find this at the website functionalmedicinepodcast.com under the documents menu.
It's going to be a good tool.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the next root cause of PCOS is that microbiome. So the gut microbiome and the vaginal microbiome, we got to address them both. And refer back to our gut health podcast series because we go way into further depth there. But we see that there's definitely this gut PCOS connection, and it plays out in fact that about 50% of women with PCOS also have irritable bowel syndrome, which is a rate far above the general population. So gut PCOS, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Lindsay, I used to do a lot of gut testing, looking at the microbiome, but I really don't do it as much anymore. If I'm looking for parasites, maybe, but here's what I found. You know, the patient spends a few hundred dollars on the test, and the answer was always the same. We all have a screwed up microbiome, right?
Right.
And so I got to thinking, well, why do the test if you know what the answer is going to be,
right?
And so how do we get to this place where we all have this screwed up microbiome? Let's start with the fact that the C-section rate in the United States was 34% last year. Whoa, Lindsay, that's huge. huge, 34%.
Yeah.
And that's it's up 500% since 1970. Now, Lindsay, you don't remember 1970, but I do. So, and I clearly understand that many of these C-sections were necessary and, in fact, life-saving for mom and for baby. So,
right.
So you know, I'm all for, you know, an appropriate C-section. However, a noted Harvard OBGYN specialist who has expertise in this area stated that the C-section rate should be ideally about 19%. And that's really important since this issue has a tremendous effect on the microbiome of the child and can result in a myriad of health effects down the road. When you add that to the fact that about 75% of babies in the United States are at least partially bottle-fed, even though the American Academy of Pediatrics states that all these kids should be exclusively breastfed during the first months of life, then all that dramatically affects their microbiome. Then you look at the issue of antibiotics, which we way overprescribe, especially the use of antibiotics in those first 3 years of life. And even look at the antibiotics in the food and water we drink. I mean, if you just go online just for the fun of it and Google antibiotics in a water supply, you'll see there's a lot of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you do with that leftover bottle of Cipro?
You just flush
it down the toilet.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, that's a safe place. My child's not going to eat it, but then it's, okay, mm-hmm, now it's in our mm-hmm. water.
That's right. It doesn't just
disappear, and then all of a sudden you're mm-hmm. antibiotic-ing yourself through water. So we mentioned all these factors since they have a huge effect on the gut microbiome, which then has an effect on PCOS.
Mm-hmm. If these women have a poor diet, like most Americans do, and with the standard American diet, which you talk about, the SAD diet, or we could call it the MAD diet, could we, the modern American diet?
Yeah,
right?
that's true.
The SAD or the
MAD
diet.
It's SAD and MAD.
Right. It's loaded with sugar and processed food. And unfortunately, these food feed the wrong bugs. Mm-hmm. And then you then get the bad guys to overgrow, and this creates even more dysbiosis. And this altered gut microbiome worsens insulin resistance, reduces the production of small-chain fatty acids, and then alters the integrity of the gut lining, creating more leaky gut, which produces more systemic inflammation, which is one of the most devastating aspects of PCOS, contributing to weight gain and directly affecting the gut-brain axis, influencing neuroinflammation, and thus contributing to mood disorders that we see in PCOS, like anxiety and depression. Now, Lindsay, that is the definition of a run-on sentence right there. My third-grade teacher would slap me on the wrist for that one. But it,
but you said it very gracefully.
Yeah, there we go. But also, the microbiome produces decreased amounts of beta-glucuronidase enzyme, which is important for hormone metabolism, and this contributes to an increased androgen level.
Unfortunately, in this world we live in, women are exposed to so many other factors that can negatively impact the microbiome. Stress, toxins, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, NSAIDs like Motrin, proton pump inhibitors like Nexium and Prilosec, and even birth control pills that all alter the gut microbiome.
So we already did several podcasts on the gut health, so we won't go into this in great detail here. However, as a part of a PCOS program, your provider should definitely work with you and put together also a kind of a customized gut health program. That's just part of it. Help restore a healthy vaginal microbiome by taking a good vaginal probiotic with Lactobacillus rhamnosus and Lactobacillus reuteri. The one we use here is called Women's Proflora by Integrative Therapeutics. And we'll try to circle back around one of these days and actually do a dedicated podcast on the vaginal microbiome in the overall vaginal ecology, which, by the way, Lindsay, is really interesting. So many women go kind of just vacillating from bacterial vaginosis to yeast infections and back and forth and back and forth because they don't have any of the good sort of, I call them the alpha dog good cop bugs in the vagina that kind of keeps control of those bugs. And
right.
So I think that we need to address that one of these days with a good podcast on the vaginal microbiome.
Yes, I think that would be
mm-hmm,
excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Then after the gut and the microbiome, we look at lifestyle factors to improve PCOS outcomes. And this is a huge part of the functional integrative approach to PCOS. And it starts with the diet.
Always diet.
It matters both what you eat, but then also when you eat. That's what we're really finding out. The when's important too. So we recommend that whole food, low-carb, calorie-restricted, plant-centered, anti-inflammatory diet that we have preached for a long time on this podcast, such as a Mediterranean-type diet. Remember, a lot of these women have problems with insulin metabolism, weight gain, and inflammation, so they need a diet that will align with all of those issues. So when we say low-carb, we mean low in simple carbs like sugar and baked goods. But the complex carbs like veggies are great. So In fact, too little food or too few carbs can actually worsen PCOS because it just kind of jerks your body more on that whole insulin metabolism issue.
So women who go on, for instance, like a keto diet, that's not cutting for PCOS.
Right. I think, you know, a lot of the research from a lot of these different providers, functional medicine providers out there are talking more about cycling some of those low-carb diets so that because women are different than men, and these hormones are different. So a lot of times that low-carb keto diet works really well for men, but not as well for women. And I think this PCOS issue kind of exemplifies that. It shows why. So because your ovaries need carbs in order to ovulate. And so the complex carbs are ideal for this. And the complex carbs also have a lot of fiber. So then we're also feeding those good bugs in your gut. So it's there's multiple things that those carbs are good for.
Yeah, that's right. And a balanced meal would include things like lean protein, a wide variety of fiber, with lots of fresh veggies, all the colors of the rainbow, bursting with those excellent antioxidants and anti-inflammatory polyphenols. Also, you want a lot of the what we call good fats, like the olive oil. I go out of my way to get extra olive oil every day, and avocado is wonderful. Ground flax is a superfood, and I have that on my oatmeal almost every morning. And my PCOS has been much better, Lindsay, since I got on my ground flax. Also, the legumes. Well, I shouldn't say that, Lindsay, should I? Because it's there, but for the grace of God, going here. Yeah, PCOS, right? Legumes, nuts, seeds, omega-3 fish are also recommended, and not enough calcium in your diet. Make sure you get enough calcium in your diet because this helps with insulin resistance. I don't necessarily recommend people take a lot of extra calcium as a supplement. I wouldn't say more than, say, 1,200 milligrams a day, but try to get it through your diet as best you can.
Yes. And so by increasing all these foods, we got to edge out some foods. Yeah, we got to push them off the conveyor belt, not add them on the grocery bill.
So what not to eat, Lindsay?
Yeah, we got to get that sugar out and those processed foods, especially those trans fats that are just going to be so highly inflammatory in your body.
Sure,
you cutting out cow's milk. And personally, with PCOS, that autoimmune connection, I feel that most women with this condition, it probably would be better off to be gluten minimal, if not gluten free. And if you are going to have that gluten, then consider an enzyme that will help your gut with breaking down the gluten appropriately. There's a great one on the market that we like to use a lot called Zygluten, and just taking that with your glutinous meal to help break down that gluten could be really helpful with your microbiome. And then you got to also watch what you drink. You got to avoid those fruit juices, those really high sugary drinks that are just going to jack up your sugar really fast. They have absolutely no fiber in them, and so it just goes straight in there and jerks your metabolism around. So fruit juice, sodas, sugar-laden alcohol like wine and mixed drinks, and we got to avoid too much caffeine as well.
And it's also important to try to eat in accordance with your circadian rhythm. You know, Lindsay, this is getting so interesting. There's this whole area of study now called chronobiology, where they're looking at the effects of the circadian rhythm on the body. And it's so interesting. Even your microbiome has a circadian rhythm to it. Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
That's very fascinating.
But there's an old saying, breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper. It kind of applies when it comes to PCOS. Or perhaps we should modify that to breakfast like a queen, lunch like a princess, and dinner like a pauper. So anyway, ideally, you should eat about most of your calories during breakfast and then have a smaller lunch and a light dinner. This significantly lowers your testosterone level, your insulin, and your cortisol level. And the last meal should be no later than 7 p.m. So that you'll ultimately fall into what we call time-restricted eating and in alignment with circadian rhythm, which is important for fertility. You'll generally need to avoid snacks, but if you must have a snack, then try to stick with what we call the fat-centered snacks, such as olives and avocado. And by the way, women tend to lose weight on this program as well, so that's kind of cool.
I think it's important to say here, you know, a lot of times we don't realize that we are eating constantly throughout the day. Like I think I've heard a statistic like 19 to 20 times we're actually having 19 meals a day. And we wouldn't count that, you know, and I think as women, you know, a lot of times one of our roles is we're preparing food in the kitchen, we're feeding our children, and I had a raspberry. I just fed my daughter a raspberry, or, you know, I'm tasting that as I'm fixing it for dinner or whatever. And that's a mini meal. That affects your insulin, affects your metabolism. And like you're saying, it's not falling into that time-restricted eating. It adds to your metabolic load. So another thing that can kind of help with your flexibility and your metabolism, so to speak, and not hitting that insulin resistance is exercise, regular exercise. And high-intensity interval training is really great for women, especially with PCOS. Just the pure strength work, like only squats and only lifting those heavy weights, that can just tend to bulk us up. So if you don't know anything about HIIT, high intensity interval training, you can check out Dr. McCullough's excellent video on YouTube. He's a great resource. We don't really have to overdo it with exercise. The main thing is that we're consistent and that we're just doing it on a regular basis. Moderation is really best with PCOS. We don't want to go all gung-ho into an hour every day and then not be able to follow up a week later. Mm-hmm. We want to be consistent. So too little is not good for you, and then too much is also not good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me make another comment on that, Lindsay. I see a lot of women with PCOS, and they really have great intentions, and they work hard, they do a lot of exercise, and I ask them, what are you doing? They say, oh, I'm seeing a trainer, and he has me doing a lot of squats and push-ups and stuff like that. But it's interesting. I find these women, they already have a lot of testosterone and DHEA, so or their T receptors are jacked up. So what happens is they easily pack on a lot of muscle. I remember back in high school when we had the cheerleading pyramid, you had what I call the base girls and the top girl. The top girl was some little 90-pound pixie that they would throw around. But the base girls were strong girls. And so PCS women tend to be base girls. And I think that those women who go see the trainers and do a lot of strength work, then I think they just bulk up. And I remember one time I was watching the Olympics. It's nice to say this now because we happen to be in the Olympics right now. But I remember there's this lady on, and she was big and powerful and proud of it. She was a weightlifter, a body. And so if a woman wants to look like that, then God bless her. Go do the strength work. But most of the women I see don't want to look like that. And so therefore, once again, I think really getting into more of a HIIT routine would be helpful for them. Make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. And other lifestyle considerations include doing your best to restore restorative sleep. And if there's any concern about sleep apnea, then get tested for it. If it's positive, then treat appropriately. Also important are things like stress reduction and building a strong, supportive community.
Beyond lifestyle, there are the general principles that help most women with PCOS, and that includes cyclical bioidentical progesterone that can be helpful. Women with PCOS tend to be low on progesterone, and so cyclical progesterone can help regulate their cycles and protect that uterine lining against cancer, and progesterone also has this anti-androgen effect.
You know, another benefit of progesterone, Lindsay, I'll mention, this is really interesting. I have found over the years there's a real what I call yin-yang to hormones. Mm-hmm. I find estrogen tends to be, it's great for things like mentation, emotions, arousal, mm-hmm. all that stuff. But progesterone is sort of the counterbalance to estrogen. It's calming, soothing, relaxing. And so I call it a woman's natural Valium. So a lot of those women who have especially like the anxiety mood component to PCOS, if you give them the cyclic progesterone in the last half of their period, it can really help with the anxiety. Mm. Really chills them right out. And especially if you use a kind of a cream in the morning and a capsule at night. The capsule at night does metabolize through the liver, and those liver metabolites tend to be much better for the anxiety than just the cream. Yeah. Okay. But it can really be an important part of the regimen. And also, thyroid optimization and adrenal support can be tremendously helpful. Then taking vitamin D3, enough to get your blood levels up between 50 and 80, and this is very important. So you have to work with your provider on that and get those levels drawn. You know, there's some people come in and they got a level of 20, and you can get them on 5,000. And sometimes that, boom, that does it. But sometimes they come back in and it's hardly budged. You got to go to 10,000, 50, or then ultimately a lot of people, I just go with the vitamin D shots, like a weekly shot, whatever. But you just got to get that D up. Taking a good B complex would be helpful, and it wouldn't hurt to take a good multivitamin. And you might find that your multi has a B complex in it. One of the multis I like a lot is a product called One One by Pure Encapsulations, which, by the way, is a great company. Unless you're trying to get pregnant, in which case you might want to go for a good prenatal vitamin. And if you are going to go for a good methylated B complex, we recommend methyl CPG. So anyway, those are some options for you on the vitamins.
And I'd also add, you know, if you are in that fertility time of your life and you're trying to get pregnant, there are several great prenatals on the market that are methylated, that mm-hmm. have those methyl Bs. Mm-hmm. So that's an important one to just be a conscious consumer of and look for when you're purchasing a prenatal. Women with PCOS are also at an increased risk of NAFLD, and that is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So milk thistle and alpha-lipoic acid are very helpful for liver and detox support for these women. Abundant hydration is, of course, just a basic principle of detox with a good filtered water. We've talked about the Berkey before. It's a wonderful, high-quality budget-friendly water filter, and they last a lifetime. And a lot of our patients get them, and they love them, and they thank us later for the recommendation. I personally travel with our Berkey. I travel with my Berkey water bottle.
We take our Berkey camping.
Yeah, and I think that's all it was originally designed for, and then it was just such a great filter that now it's a household filter.
That's
it's so wonderful.
And once you drink Berkey water, you don't want regular water. It just tastes so much better.
Yes.
You could easily find them online. Just go, I don't know if it's Berkey.com or whatever, just look up Berkey online. You can easily get them.
Stress reduction is, again, you guys hear me preaching on stress, so it's an essential part mm-hmm. of an integrative mm-hmm. approach for PCOS. So mm-hmm. get a program and check out our stress podcast we did.
Yeah. You know, Lindsay, most of the time when you're reading a book on PCOS or listening to a podcast on PCOS, they have just these therapies listed, which are wonderful. But what I realized is that every woman has her unique problems with PCOS. And so what I've tried to do here in this podcast is kind of break it down to the specific issues so we can kind of isolate it to your issues. So,
yes.
So let's talk about some of the major issues with the PCOS. And the first and most common one is the insulin resistance. Major problem for many of these women. And as I said, this often then includes the inflammation and the androgens that go along with it. But, of course, treatment starts with those lifestyle things like a low-carb diet, and especially things like the high-fructose corn syrup that you find in most sodas and soft drinks and sports drinks. They got to go. Add some, we talked about ground flax earlier, so sesame seeds, and stick to the 8-hour eating window in alignment with circadian rhythms. And this can all help with the insulin resistance. The weight loss and the HIIT exercise that we mentioned above can also improve insulin resistance.
And we've already mentioned that metformin can be a go-to conventional medical therapy for this. We generally recommend this for most women with PCOS. However, the use of metformin in women who are wanting to become pregnant in the near future is controversial, so we'll have to talk about that in greater detail in the fertility section.
Mm-hmm. And some of these supplements that may be helpful to improve insulin resistance include chromium picolinate. And once again, I'll have doses for you in the documents section on the website. Fenugreek, magnesium, NAC, which stands for N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, a good high-quality fish oil, vitamin D, zinc, selenium, berberine, resveratrol, myo-inositol, and DCI, which is D-chiro-inositol. And you can add manganese to increase the effectiveness of the DCI. And by the way, if you read the ingredients on your multi, you might find that many of these ingredients are included right in your multi.
And I love a good high-quality mercury-free fish oil, or just making sure that you really are eating omega-3-rich fish at least 3 times a week. And like we've already mentioned, decreasing those omega-6s that are anti-inflammatory. Low thyroid worsens insulin resistance, so it's important that you do optimize your thyroid function. And again, we got to throw in that work with a functional medicine practitioner who can really help you with that. Adaptogens are also a great resource here, like ashwagandha, which may reduce insulin resistance, but they are not approved for the use in pregnancy. So you got to know that you can use them unless your goal is fertility.
Mm-hmm. So the next situation we'll look at is the situation where women have symptoms of high androgens, the male hormones, and those symptoms that we talked about before would be acne, facial hair, body hair, all that kind of stuff. The therapy starts with the diet, as always, and maintaining ideal body weight, which tend to lower androgen levels. Cyclic bioidentical progesterone, and the progesterone helps by blocking the androgen receptors.
And then some great anti-androgen supplements include that NAC that Dr. McMahon, you mentioned, and acetylcysteine. black cohosh, reishi mushrooms, resveratrol, myo-inositol, D-chiro-inositol, and then supplementation of omega-3 fatty acids, aka fish oils. Berberine's also really good, and it can help reduce acne. And zinc can be helpful with hirsutism or that excess hair issue.
Mm-hmm. And as you can see, Lindsay, there's a lot of overlap between some of the supplements recommended for the high androgen issues and the insulin issues.
Right.
There's another supplement called the peony and licorice. This is a traditional Chinese medicine combo that reduces androgens. Spearmint tea may also be helpful. I recommend about 2 cups a day of a good organic spearmint tea.
And melatonin can reduce testosterone levels. Some women like it since it can help with their sleep, but you got to watch out for some women may react negatively, and that melatonin can cause low energy and weight gain. And then there's also a prescription product called the
Vanika.
Vanika, thank you, which is a topical cream that can be used for facial hair.
And that is a prescription item, so you have to get that from your provider. A subset of this type of PCOS is the hair loss, and so check out my book entitled Hair Loss in Women, which is available on Amazon. And listen to the podcast we did on hair loss in women, and you'll find a wealth of information in the book.
And then we can kind of move on to for the women whose major problem is systemic inflammation. Always start with lifestyle measures here, diet and exercise, and then that good high-quality mercury-free fish oil, eating the omega-3 rich fish 3 times a week, and then other anti-inflammatory supplements could be zinc, 25 to 30 milligrams per day at a meal. Magnesium glycinate's another great choice, about 300 to 500 milligrams per day. N-acetylcysteine, 600 milligrams per day. Curcumin is a wonderful anti-inflammatory to have in our toolbox. And again, optimizing your vitamin D is important here, considering a good bioflavonoid such as quercetin. And then just getting plenty of good antioxidants. Vitamin C is the age-old wonderful one that we all know, and vitamin E or a mixed tocopherol blend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And for those women who suffer with post-pill PCOS, again, it starts with the lifestyle measures, as always. Then be patient. Androgens will usually come down, but that can be gradual on their own over 6 months to a year or even a couple of years. The main supplements for this variety of PCOS are the zinc and the peony/licorice combo.
And finally, for those women with PCOS whose main issue is ovulation and fertility, it's important to state right off the bat that 70% of women with PCOS do conceive naturally. So don't think that just because you have PCOS, you can't have a baby. The best place to start is with preconception care. And ideally, both partners participate in this. It takes both a healthy egg and a healthy sperm to have a healthy baby. And you really want to set apart some time to work on that preconception health and at least 3 to 4 months to get healthy before you even get to the point of starting to try. Would be something that we would encourage people. So take a look at the meds that you're on. Make sure those are okay with pregnancy. And a great website for that is www.infantrisk.com or check out Mommy Meds app. It's also really helpful. And here's one you don't hear all the time from everybody, but flossing regularly is really important in maintaining good oral health. Gingivitis is associated with fertility problems and an increased risk of miscarriage.
And I do think it would be helpful to establish exactly what's going on with ovulation. I recommend using a basal body temperature and period tracking app such as Fertility Friend. I've checked out a lot of the apps, and I like that one a lot because it's free. It's really easy to use. And there are a couple of great books that will also help you to figure out what's going on with your ovulation. And one is a wonderful book called Taking Charge of Your Fertility. And the other one should be a mandatory reading for every woman and really every doctor, called The Period Repair Manual. Those are two of my favorites. Another option to check out is the Clear Blue Advanced Digital Ovulation Tests.
Dr. Whitman, I just think that understanding our fertility as women is it's a life skill.
Well, you know,
like driving a car. Yeah, but we don't teach our girls
what's
going on with their body and discharge at different points, that's normal and this is what it looks like. And you know, it's just not a tool that anybody grows up having, but it's so fundamental.
It is. I've heard it called the fifth vital sign. you know, and you know, understanding what's going on with your periods, and oh my gosh, it's, we're shameful in not teaching women about their bodies.
Right.
And to your point, as young girls, we should be teaching them, and we all need to get better at this. Doctors do, women do,
but and it's not all just about sex and reproduction.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, right.
Like, but, there's so much more to our cycles than that, and we limit ourselves by not understanding our bodies.
Right. So start by reading that wonderful book, The Period Repair Manual. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dr. Rimmon. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just had a mini soapbox
on that.
As always, you'll want to hit your lifestyle fundamentals hard when we're talking about fertility stuff. Yoga can improve menstrual irregularity and can also improve fertility and pregnancy outcomes. And you just doing this on a regular basis, it's also going to help with that stress as well, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. we keep talking about. You can find all sorts of great free tools on YouTube. Some of our favorites, Melissa, Ali Kalmanova. I love Yoga with Adrian. Mm-hmm. There's so many great ones.
Any other favorites?
Free. You know, Adrian's usually my go-to.
I really like her. Yeah, I've really done Melissa a lot lately, and Ali's good as well. But they're all great. And they're all free. Check them out. You can do it right there at home. Won't cost you a penny. There's a style of yoga called Kundalini yoga, which I think is particularly good for pelvic blood flow and those kind of things. Now, I know, Lindsay, you do goat yoga. Lindsay, the farm girl, and she gets out there with the goats and does goat yoga.
We have some great farmer friends, and they do that, and it's wonderful. Yeah, the chickens are running around too, which makes it really interesting.
That's great. And of course, don't underestimate the power of the mind-body connection. Try to maybe check out some guided imagery and things like affirmations. There's a nice site called www.healthyjourneys.com. You can just go there and search for lots of different topics, and you can just do a search for fertility, and you'll see some guided imagery type things for fertility especially.
Low thyroid impedes ovulation, so it's important to optimize thyroid function. Also, thyroid affects the IQ of the baby, or it can have an effect on the IQ of the baby, so you'll need to work with a provider to get that TSH, that thyroid stimulating hormone, down below 2.0.
Yeah, let me comment a little bit more on that, Lindsay. I think so many doctors say, well, your thyroid's normal, and they're right, it is, mm-hmm. but it's not optimal. You don't want to be low normal in this situation. You want to have your thyroid optimized and get that TSH down maybe like 1 to 2 or so in that range. Also, too much insulin impairs ovulation, so work on that insulin sensitivity, and we've already discussed that. Cut out the caffeine, since caffeine tends to increase the risk of miscarriage were you to get pregnant. And then also consider avoiding gluten. In some people, not all, but even without celiac disease, gluten can affect fertility and miscarriage rate.
Also avoid sodas, since those can increase ovulatory infertility. Drink plenty of good filtered water, and that will help also improve your cervical mucus. And if you do use marijuana, you may want to consider quitting that. Marijuana can alter your menstrual cycle, reduce fertility, and can increase your risk of preterm labor.
Now, back to the metformin issue. Let me explore that just a little bit more. It does restore the normal menstrual cycle in about 50% of women with PCOS, which is huge. It can also improve fertility and reduce the gestational diabetes. And it can also help with the weight issue. It's been rated as pregnancy category B, which means it's safe to use in pregnancy. However, some concern has emerged recently concerning the fact that it does cross the placenta and that the offspring exposed to metformin has an increased incidence of obesity later in life.
Wow.
So it's controversial. I mean, it can seem like it can be a game changer as far as your ability to ovulate. But once again, it can have some repercussions later in life. I think most doctors still recommend it and use it. But I'm just saying, I think some concern is emerging over it. Yeah.
Right. And again, we're about education and empowerment here. So optimizing your blood vitamin D levels to getting them somewhere in the range of 50 to 80. You can safely start with 2,000 IUs of vitamin D3 per day and then check your blood levels to make sure that you're optimized. And if needed, you can increase that dose till you get optimized into that target range.
And if you're deficient in iodine, you can correct this since your ovaries need iodine to ovulate. Your provider can determine if you're deficient by doing what we call an iodine challenge test. Also, take a good prenatal vitamin since it can increase fertility. Make sure it contains methylfolate, choline, iodine, zinc, and iron. Add some extra B6 in the form of P5P. Also, the fish oil, as we mentioned, and extra vitamin C.
And get that vaginal microbiome in shape by taking a probiotic that contains a broad spectrum of bugs, including that Lactobacillus rhamnosus and Lactobacillus reuteri.
Wonderful, wonderful. Some supplements that can improve ovulation and fertility include the myo-inositol, dichiro-inositol, black cohosh, maitake mushrooms. Mushrooms are amazing, aren't they, Lindsay?
Mm-hmm, yeah, they are.
NAC, which is the N-acetylcysteine, L-carnitine, zinc, alpha-lipoic acid, berberine, fish oils, and melatonin.
You know, there's also an interesting product called the Fertility Blend for Women that has some pretty good science behind it. It contains a mix of supplements and herbs that seem to result in an increased fertility rate. So it might be something to look into.
Yeah, and that's easily available online. And Vitex can help with ovulation and fertility. However, it can also worsen some of the symptoms of PCOS. I think it's worth a try. Vitex is a pretty amazing herb. However, if the PCOS symptoms tend to worsen, then you can stop it. And by the way, it is one of the ingredients in the Fertility Blend product that we just mentioned.
Resveratrol and CoQ10 in the form of ubiquinol can improve egg quality. And if you get pregnant, then go ahead and add some magnesium glycinate, 400 milligrams per day. That can reduce preeclampsia or pre-E. And add some choline, about 90 milligrams per day, for optimal brain development in baby.
And the peony licorice extract together increases ovulation. However, there are a few precautions to keep in mind. Watch your blood pressure. Don't take it if you're younger than 18 years old. Don't take it with any other fertility drugs. And don't take it for more than 6 months in a row. And finally, I'll mention that acupuncture may be very helpful in inducing regular ovulation. How does it work? I don't have a clue. But I have witnessed it personally. The power of qi is amazing. I've seen it with my own eyes. It can make babies when nothing else works. Remember Dr. Margo?
Yeah.
These women would come to her and everything else had failed. Right. And she would do acupuncture and, oh my gosh, a bunch of them got pregnant. It's really cool. Yeah.
It is amazing. So then we got to get down to the business of trying. And as we said before, it's really important to be empowered of how to track your cycles and how to monitor your cervical mucus. The mucus that you really want is going to be clear and stretchy like egg whites. And that, you know, happens at the certain time of the month when you're about to ovulate. And that's when you're most fertile. You can have the unprotected sex at least every other day for 5 days before your cycle and on the day of ovulation. And you can learn more about this in the wonderful book, Taking Charge of Your Fertility. You can also find other fertility practitioners that'll help you chart your cycle and work through that.
And one last comment. We're almost done. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, y'all. I promise we'll be done in a minute. But anyway, PCOS can be a difficult, discouraging, frightening, and lonely journey. Women with PCOS need support everywhere they can get it. Check out some of the online support groups that connect with other women who are going through the same thing you are. Share ideas and success stories with these other women. Gather your support team, your partner, your friends, your family, your GYN doctor, your functional medicine provider, your counselor, your pastor, your dietitian, your health coach, whoever you need to help you become the very best version of yourself. You should not go through this journey alone, and you are not defined by your PCOS.
Amen. That's a good word. And that'll about do it for this episode of the Functional Medicine Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for this really important topic. We hope that you were able to find some information here that was helpful to you.
And don't forget to check us out at functionalmedicinepodcast.com. You'll find some resources there that I just mentioned earlier. And you can also check us out at mcmahonclinic.com. And please subscribe to us and take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You know, I was trying to figure out how to do that. On my sort of podcast search engine, you can't rate us. But you go to the iTunes podcast search engine and go to our site. Then you can actually go to the podcast. And you scroll down to the bottom to see little stars there. You can click on a star. Click on a five-star, please.
Yes. Give us some more stars.
Yeah, we need some five. So anyway, but yeah, also just tell your friends and family about us. And
we always want to shout out to Ben Wedlin. He's our recording engineer. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate you.
And now, Lindsay, leave us with another final Coach Lindsay pearl of wisdom.
Oh, my goodness, Dr. McMahon. What a exciting topic today.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, I was driving here today and just thinking about this podcast. And I just, you know, I got really passionate about it because I just feel like, you know, this is going to be a rising problem.
It's only going
to increase.
Yeah.
And knowledge is power, as we've already talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And But I think starting points for everybody here, whether no matter what type of PCOS you fall right. under, no matter where you are on the spectrum, is really going back to these root causes that we've mm-hmm. talked about. Mm-hmm. And inflammation is a big one, and detox is a big one.
Right.
And I think, you know, just kind of keeping in mind those big perspectives. And as you said before, like, this is reversible. There is hope. Right. And you just got to get started.
Right. And these women need to be taken seriously.
Yes.
I think sometimes we sweep women's health issues under the rug. And so anyway, well, we thank you so much for listening. That should about wrap it up for us today. This is Dr. McMinn.
And Coach Lindsay.
Take care and be well.